Chapter 2 Turnaround. Paul has been at loose ends ever since he finished his dissertation. And it really was finished more completely than most scientific theses, since he couldn't make new measurements or read current research on the topic, which was data granulation in surveys of gravitational lensing in globular clusters, 2002 to 2085. So, the approach of turnaround was a great outlet for his stalled energies. He had a checklist, with nearly 1,000 items, compiled before we left, and he added a few himself. The original list didn't say anything about making sure the balalaikas were secured. We will be in zero-G for a little over 2 days, while our dirty iceberg slowly turns to pointed jet toward the others. The Martians will love it. I'm looking forward to the novelty myself. Good memories. Taking care of the plants won't be the big project it was before we took off. Just keep everything damp. Try not to crash into anything while cruising from place to place. I do have one big irrational worry. Nobody has ever stopped and restarted a huge engine like this one. The test vehicle was hardly 1,000th this mass. What if it doesn't start? Nobody really knows what makes it work anyhow. Maybe they do by now, on Earth. But if it didn't restart, and we radioed, what do we do now? It would be more than 24 years before we got the answer. Slam the doors and try again. Even Flying Amber, who wouldn't blink at the second coming, seemed a little excited about turnaround. Well, it will be the journey's midpoint, as well as a brief respite from the burden of Earth-style gravity. He was not happy that we had to drain their makeshift pool, and Paul was not happy about having to recycle the water separately to keep all their germs and cooties in their own ecosystem. Our own pool came with a watertight cover. We had the furniture secured and the plants taken care of a couple of hours before Paul was to shut down the engine. Namir prepared a luxury feast. Lamb chops baked with rehydrated fruit and Middle Eastern spices served over couscous. We opened one of the few bottles of actual wine. After a pastry dessert, Paul checked his wrist and got up from the table. 48 minutes, he said. I'll turn it off at 2200 sharp. No need for a countdown? We all agreed. I'll go remind the Martians, Namir said. When will you start the rotation? After a general systems check, maybe an hour. Don't think we'll feel anything. 6 degrees per hour? Two small steering jets on opposite sides of the ice ball's equator would get us slowly spinning, then stop us 28 hours later. I had a queasy feeling that maybe I should have dined on soda crackers and water instead, Paul's reassurance is notwithstanding. It was a little more than waiting for the other shoe to drop. I went back to the bathroom and found a stomach pill. It didn't help that Moon Boy sat there with his drugged smile, listening to the music of the spheres. When Merrill told him what was about to happen, he typed out, "Looking forward to it. Noise might stop." Sure, if life support stops. To distract myself, I went to the bicycle machine and took a VR ride through downtown Paris, trying to hit every man with a mustache. At about 5 minutes to the hour, I joined the others in the compromise lounge. Everyone had filled squeeze bottles with water and other things to drink in zero-G. Good idea. I went to the storeroom and drew 6 liters of water in a plastic cow and concentrate for 2 liters of wine, which made a red light blink next to my name. Paul's light wasn't blinking, so I drew a couple of liters for him, too. He must have been too busy, hovering over the off switch. I returned to the lounge with my armloads of water and wine. "You are ready for a party," Snowbird said. I croaked out a catchphrase that meant something like, "I wish the same state for you." She clapped lightly with her small hands. We were all sort of braced for it when 2200 came, but of course it wasn't like slamming on the brakes. Gravity just stopped. I pushed off gently and floated toward the ceiling. Namir and Snowbird followed.
"I guess nothing went wrong," Meryl said, rotating by in a slow somersault.
Moonboy hadn't moved. He took off the earphones and listened intently for a couple of seconds.
"Still there." He put them back on, hovering a foot off the couch. Elsa floated up to join Namir, clasping him with her arms and legs. Well, he wouldn't be able to shoot pool. Have to do something for 2 days.
Paul came out of the control room walking on the floor with his gecko slippers. He had a strange expression. My stomach fell as he spoke.
"Something screwy."
He shook his head. The proximity. There was a faint metallic sound. Then three more.
"The airlock," Namir said.
Surprise, then terror.
Inappropriately, I laughed, and so did Meryl.
"Has to be the others," Paul said.
"Might as well let them in," Namir said, "before they just blow it open."
The people who designed the ship should have put a camera out there. But we hadn't expected callers. We all followed Paul, all of us but Moonboy, floating various trajectories toward the airlock. Paul opened the control box and pushed the open sequence button. A pump hammered for less than a minute, fading as the air was sucked out of the lock. The outer door opened onto total darkness. There was a moment of terrible suspense. Then a man, in a conventional white spacesuit, used a navigating jet to float in, and stopped by touching the inner door window.
"I'll be damned," Dustin said. "They caught up with us this soon?"
"We talked about the possibility of Earth's inventing a speedier spacecraft, which would catch up with us. Turnaround would be a logical place to meet when our engine was turned off."
"No," Paul said. "If they were from Earth, they would have radioed."
He pushed the close sequence button, and the outer door closed, and the air sighed back into the little sealed room. The inner door opened, and the stranger floated out toward us. He, or she, or it, undid the helmet clasps and let the helmet float away. A male, in his 20s or 30s, no obvious ethnicity.
"Good for you. You didn't try to kill me."
"You're another?" Paul said.
"No, of course not."
It wasn't looking at Paul, just studying each of us in turn. "They couldn't speak to you in real time. Your lives are trivially short and swift. I'm an artificial biological construct, like you two Martians, created to mimic a human rate of perception and reaction. I'm a tool, made by a tool. The one who communicated with you from Triton."
"Who tried to destroy the Earth," Paul said.
"Only the life on Earth, yes. I was made in case you survive that. As I believe you know, the one who made me lives slower and longer than humans or Martians, but is still a mayfly compared to the others."
"It left Triton, though," Paul said, "just before the explosion."
"Yes. It is here now, in a small habitat near your airlock, fastened to the iceberg by now. We've been nearby for some time, within a few million miles, but of course did not physically connect until your engine stopped."
"Why are you here?" I asked.
"To keep an eye on us?"
"That, yes. And to help decide whether you should be allowed near the others' home planet."
"Then you're set up to destroy us, as Red was?"
"Not at all. It's not necessary."
His expression revealed nothing. It was not neutral exactly, but more controlled than the serving robots at McDonald's.
"Because the others themselves won't let us get close enough to hurt them," Namir said.
"That's correct. We have already begun sending them information. I think the more you let me know, the better your chances will be."
"Do you have a name?" I asked.
"No. You may call me whatever you please."
Spy, Amir said.
Considering the source, it said, I am honored.
You know a lot about us, I said.
Only what has been public knowledge on Earth. Namir, Elza, Paul, Carmen, Dustin, Merrill, Snowbird, Flyin' Amber, it pointed. That would be Moonboy. He was facing away from us, floating halfway to the kitchen, listening to music.
Yes, Merrill said.
He's not feeling well.
Perhaps none of you are.
It looked around.
I will be as small a burden as possible. I will spend most of my time in my quarters, with the other. Conversation necessarily takes a long time. Once we have deceleration, I can walk back and forth at will. The external airlock control is simple. I didn't use it this time because I didn't want to frighten you with an alarm.
That was neighborly, I said. Can I offer you something to eat or drink?
Oh, no. I don't want to burden your life support. I can take care of that in my own ship. Like the Martians, I consume very little.
We were made by intelligent design, Snowbird said. Not haphazard evolution.
She had been studying the history of human science, but it was correct. Martians needed only a third of the life support mass humans required.
Being indifferent to what you eat or drink is a factor, too. If we were willing to live on hardtack biscuits and water, we could save a lot of reaction mass.
You took a chance coming over here, Paul said. One course correction and you'd be adrift.
I'm replaceable. How often do you do that?
Every few days.
Enough to keep us from going outside.
A reasonable risk. It looked around. I would like to have a tour of your ship if you don't mind. Then you may tour ours.
Paul nodded slowly.
We have nothing to hide.
I can speak consensus Martian, it said, turning to Flyin' Amber. Would you guide me?
Flyin' Amber trilled a yes sound, and they headed off toward the Martian rooms.
A logical starting place, but both Paul and Namir looked unhappy.
Wish it had chosen you, Paul said to Snowbird.
I wish that as well, she said. I'm curious.
And more communicative, I didn't bother to add.
Flyin' Amber might remember every detail, but we'd have to drag it out of him if he didn't feel like talking.
Well, come into the control room, Paul said. We'll see what their ship looks like.
I put on my gecko slippers and followed him. We waited at the door for the others.
General, he said as he walked in, and the control surfaces morphed to that configuration. A lot more dials and knobs and switches than the set he'd been using.
He strapped himself into the swivel seat and said, "Outside view." There was a flat screen a meter square in front of him, and it darkened to a velvet blackness with a thousand sparks. He twiddled a joystick, and the angle veered around dizzyingly, until it came to rest on a familiar view of the iceberg surface, with a decidedly unfamiliar visitor.
It didn't look like a spaceship. It didn't look like a machine at all.
It looked kind of like a starfish, with seven legs, pebbly skin that was mottled red and black, with filaments like cilia or antennae wiggling on ribs that ran down each leg.
It would have looked right at home on the ocean floor if it were hand-sized.
But it was easily half as big as the Ad Astra landing craft.
I wonder what makes it tick, Namir said. It can't be carrying enough reaction mass for interstellar travel. Well, if it's the same thing that left Triton, it took off at 25 Gs, Paul said. That argues for something more exotic than we've got. Spy says they've been following us for who knows how long,
so I guess it went out far enough to be undetectable, then just watched and waited. Then tailed us at its leisure. He cranked up the magnification and slowly examined the thing. No obvious portholes or gun ports or wheels or grommets. I suppose if you examined a starfish with a magnifying glass, you would see about the same thing. Maybe it's alive, too, Merrill said. The way Martians are, and Spy claims to be. Grown for a specific purpose.
I would vote for that, Snowbird said.
Looks like a relative, Dustin said.
In a way. If the others have an aesthetic, and our design reflects it, so does the vehicle's design. Don't you think?
See what you mean, I said. Though, aesthetic isn't the word I would have chosen.
It was almost ugly.
But then, so were the Martians until you got used to them. I went back to my workstation and considered the pictures of the ship, thinking of it in terms of a living organism. I'd studied Terran invertebrates, of course, and remembered a seven-legged starfish. I clicked around and found the one I remembered, a pretty British creature, nicely symmetrical and less than a foot wide. There was also a seven-legged one from New Zealand waters, almost a yard wide, that looked octopoid and menacing, and in fact a footnote warned that if it grabbed your wetsuit, it was almost impossible to pry loose. But it was the slender British one, Luidia ciliaris, that resembled the starship. Nothing but its shape was relevant, of course. The only other creature I could find with seven legs, other than sadly mutated spiders, was the extinct Hallucigenia sparsa, a tiny but mean-looking fossil. The only picture we had of the others was a simple diagram they sent that we interpreted as having six legs and a tail. Maybe they did have seven legs instead. So built a starship in their own image. It was an odd shape for a vehicle. Counterintuitive. But maybe my intuitions would be different if I had a seven-based number system. Zero-G isn't conducive to abstract thinking, which may be one reason space pilots have not distinguished themselves as philosophers. Another reason may be that they are basically jocks with fast reflexes. I pinged my pilot and said I was going to nap for a while, and he joined me in the bedroom for a few minutes of not napping. Then we did doze together, floating in midair with a sweat-damp sheet wrapped around us. I dreamed of monsters.